Did you know that your medical school application GPA will likely not be the same as your transcript GPA? There are lots of reasons for that, and it can be frustrating, but there is a free, easy way to calculate your medical school application GPA at mapped.com. That's MAPPD.com. Using Mapped app, which is now free to use for a GPA calculator, this is a new change. So if you've checked out Mapped before, if it's been a while, go check it out. We've come a long way with Mapped app. And now with our free tier, after your 30-day free trial, using the referral code 30 days free, that's all one word, all capital letters, 30, the number 30 days free. After that free trial of using all of the amazing features inside of Mapped, you can now continue to use Mapped for free. Again, that's mapped.com, MAPPD.com. The pre-med year, session number 442. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. And welcome to The Pre-Med Years. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you're listening to this live on May 12th, 2021. Today's the last day to pre-order my new book, The Pre-Med Playbook Guide to the Medical School Application Process, and submit your receipt at medschoolapplicationbook.com/submit. When you do that, you'll get a PDF of all of my books, my application process book, MCAT book, personal statement book, interview book, all of the Pre-Med Playbook series, as well as access to two recorded calls, Q&A calls that we did for earlier pre-order students. And there's still a chance to enter to win one of five coaching calls with me. So go check those out. Again, go pre-order my new book, The Pre-Med Playbook Guide to the Medical School Application Process. And did you know registration is open? We're going to jump into our MCAT Minute sponsored by Blueprint MCAT. Registration is open. If you're taking the test in July, August, September, go register for your exam now. The question, though, for you is if you're applying this cycle in 2021 to start in 2022, taking the MCAT in July, August, and September is an increased risk of having schools ignore your application because they've already interviewed all of the people, or at least invited all of the people that they're going to interview, or they're reserving spots for very specific populations that that school wants to serve. So you have to be careful with later MCAT dates when you are applying. The ideal time frame to take the MCAT for any application cycle is before or at least March or April of the year you are applying. So this year you're applying 2021 to start 2022. You want to take the MCAT no later than March or April of 2021. That's the MCAT Minute sponsored by Blueprint. Go check them out at blueprintmcat.com. Sign up for a free account and get access to tons of free goodies. Today, we have a recording of our Inside Med Admissions panel that happened a few weeks ago, and it was all about letters of recommendations. We had some great guests this time, directors of admissions from NORDA College of Osteopathic Medicine, the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and Dell Medical School. Hosted by Dr. Scott Wright, my VP of Academic Advising at Mapped. If you're looking for some help with your application or anything else, go check out mapped.com/services. That's MAPPD.com for Mapped. This is a great discussion. You'll learn a lot about letters of recommendation, why they're important, what you can do about them, and sign up for our next session, which is happening May 26th, live at 1 p.m. Eastern. We're going to talk about secondary applications.
Welcome to inside Med Admissions. And we're going to have a great day today talking about letters of recommendation. And I want to get quickly to all of our guests today and have them introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about who they are and what their role is in the admissions process, and give us just a little bit of an overview of your kind of your history in medical school admissions, or in whatever your deal has been over time. So we'll start off with Dr. Layla Amiri. And Layla, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Scott. Hi, everyone. I am Layla Amiri, the Assistant Dean for Admissions and Recruitment at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. And I have a long history with health professions. I actually started as a undergraduate peer advisor in the biology department and just worked my way through the ranks into pre-med advising. And then I've been doing admissions in the medical school arena since 2009. So where I am currently is the fourth medical school I had the privilege to work.
That's awesome.
Happy to be here today.
Yeah, great. Thank you for being here. I think this will be a great time for you to kind of help us understand kind of your process and your recognition of the process at the various medical schools of where you've been on staff. So great. So Kristen, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit? Let us know about you.
Okay. My name is Kristen Anderson. I'm the Director of Admissions at the Nordic College of Osteopathic Medicine in Provo, Utah. And I've been the director there for a whole almost 9 months. but before that, we're a brand new school, but before that, I worked as a pre-health advisor at a local university for 8 years. I did 1 year of pre-PA and pre-pharmacy advising, and then did 7 years of pre-medical advising.
So awesome.
I kind of had a similar kind of start. I came from advising into admissions, like Dr. Amiri.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very good. Thank you for being with us, Kristen. It's nice to
have you here. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. And Joel, tell us about yourself a little bit.
Well, good afternoon, Scott. Thanks for the opportunity to visit with y'all. My name is Joel DeBow. I'm Director of Admissions and Records at Dell Medical School. And Scott, when you asked how long we've been doing this, I had to think for a second. So I have been involved in college admissions now for about 31 years. Both at the undergraduate level and as in the professional school level over the last, I guess, 12 or 14 years. And it's in the last 6 years, I've worked with a new medical school and helped start the selection process for a brand new school, which has been probably one of the more rewarding experiences of my career. So it's been a lot of fun.
Excellent. And Dell Medical School, I will have to point out, Dell Medical School is right here in Austin, Texas, where I am currently as well. And I noticed, Joel, that you've got your burnt orange shirt on in recognition of your allegiance to the Longhorns, I suppose. And
so, well, that's allegiance to my paycheck, Scott. So
Totally get it. Well, thank you all three for joining us today. What I would like to start off with is just to get each of you to give us a little bit of an insight. After all, the name of this broadcast is Inside Med Admissions. And so the goal here is to give the students that are listening and watching us is give them a little insight on what the process is like inside the admissions committee, inside how things work, and relevant here to letters of recommendation. What I would like to know is kind of how do each of you in your process of the admission selection process, how do you use letters of recommendation? Let's just start off with that. Give us a little bit of an insight into what goes into when your admissions committee, when the members are looking at the application and they're looking at letters of recommendation, well, how do you use those in kind of a big picture type of way? And then we'll drill down a little bit to understanding a little bit more specifically various aspects of that. But give us an overall picture of kind of how that works in your process. And Joel, since we were just talking, let's start with you.
Sure. So the letters of recommendation are reviewed during the admissions committee evaluation. So this is at the point of decision. So what has happened up to that point? The applicant has been pre-screened for selection for interview and has been reviewed based on the non-cognitive variables to make that choice. The student has then come into the institution now virtually interviewed, and those evaluations have been compiled. And then the entire packet, the application, those recommendation, interview, experience, evaluations are all sent to the committee for review. And so the letters of recommendation are viewed in that context. So it allows us to put together other people's perspective of that applicant and behavior that we observe either at the interview day or through their past behavior in their application. So it gives and lends context to the entire application.
Awesome. Great. Great. Layla, why don't you tell us a little bit about how it works on your end of things? And
sure, I'm happy to. So for us, the letters are reviewed as part of the screening process. And what we're looking for is information above and beyond what the candidate has already provided to us by virtue of the personal statement and the experiences and activities that they've provided to us. Really, those intangible parts of their personality that are not accessible by just what they've shared with us. So we will assess that at the screening stage. We will have comments on the strength of the letter of recommendation and how much additional information it provides. If I can just take a moment here, Scott. So, you know, some letters are more in depth and they give you more insight into the candidate, whereas some letters are a little bit more about the letter writer. And then there's a few comments at the end that says, well, my class is really hard and, you know, only 2% pass and this person got an A and therefore, you know, so that letter would be less informative, would not hurt the candidate, but less informative. The other one would give us a little bit more detail. Then the letter, the entire packet goes forward to our committee on admissions for consideration of interview. And at that point, the letters are revisited by the committee on admissions individuals. And when the student comes in for interview, the interviewers do not have access to the letters. Then they come back into the game again at the time when we're deliberating over admissions, just like Joel mentioned.
Yeah, good. Excellent. And Kristen?
So our process is not unlike both of theirs. So we do require the letters of recommendation to be submitted as part of the supplemental or secondary application. That's when they're actually due to us and will be evaluated for meeting the requirements. And then from there, students are invited to complete a virtual, this year was a virtual interview. We're hoping to bring back in-person interviews in the next cycle, we'll see. And then the interviewers actually don't have access to the letters of recommendation. They only have access to a video secondary that the applicants submit as part of their supplemental materials, and then their personal statement, and then they complete the interview with the interviewer. And then all of the interview feedback, along with the letters of recommendation and other application materials without GPA and MCAT scores, are forwarded on to the admissions committee, who then evaluate, make decisions and recommendations from there.
Excellent. So very similar in a lot of ways, with the exception of, I think, Joel, in terms of you guys kind of looking at letters maybe a little bit later in the process than Kristen and Layla. So that's excellent. So I guess one of the things that students often are very interested in and concerned about is getting a good letter, getting a strong letter of recommendation from their faculty or whatever. And so one of the questions that I really wanted to get addressed today is, what makes a letter great? You know, what differentiates? And Layla, you sort of alluded to this a little bit in your comments earlier. So let's start off with you here and just say, what is it that makes a letter really great? What is it when you read a letter and you think, wow, this is a standout kind of letter here? What is it that looks like? What makes that happen?
So, you know, we like to see a letter that shows understanding of the candidate, right? And time spent with the candidate and personal interactions with the candidate. So for example, for our program, we require 3 faculty letters. So for a faculty letter, we would like to hear that they've had discussions and conversations with the student, that the student is able to think critically and has been able to analyze the information, maybe pull it, pull in information from other sources to things that they've been discussing. But really it is the personal relationship that the faculty member has had with the student, and they can give us more insight into the individual. If it is a personal recommendation, because we'll accept personal recommendations as well, so if it's their volunteering coordinator, for example, or the PI to their research lab, again, it's, the times that the individual has gone above and beyond, or the PI will share with us individual experiences that they've had with this candidate that have set them apart from others that they've known. So really, this is an introduction to how they would be as a person outside of the carefully curated items that they've submitted to us as part of their application. So that's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
Those little nuggets.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Joel, what are your thoughts here? What makes a letter great?
Well, if I would follow with what Layla's saying is insight. She commented about the letter we see sometimes too often, which is the letter about the letter writer, and then a little bit about the student at the end. And that it tells us a little bit about the decision-making process of the applicant. Who you pick to write your letters gives us some insight about you as well. And so you want to pick individuals who are going to be able to speak to certain attributes that you want to highlight. If you want to talk about your ability to solve problems, then having somebody write a letter about how you came against a difficulty, an obstacle, how you overcame that, and what steps you went through to get through that. If you want to highlight some experience you did in leadership, then have somebody who can write that letter that reflects on their personal experience with you and how you collaborated with others to make that happen. So I was playing with this idea of this analogy, and it probably won't come off very well. But so if you think about every applicant as a gemstone of multiple facets, and what you, as an applicant, what you want to decide is, where do I want to shine the light to make a certain facet sparkle that people can see about, reinforce something I've done in my application. And so I would encourage you to also think about the 3 types of letters. And Lena has a requirement that they all come from faculty. We don't have that requirement. But you can also do a supplemental letter or a 4th letter as well. But what you want to be able to do is find voices that can speak about different aspects of who you are, as opposed to one voice or multiple voices speak about one facet. So think about what you're trying to illuminate in your application, and that helps us better understand who you are. So a letter that does that is more effective than, as Layla pointed out, the perfunctory letter that sometimes we get.
Yeah. And I know that you like I, Joel, and the rest of you, having been around this business for a long time, we get this question a lot from students. Well, my classes are huge. There's 350 students in my general chemistry class, or there's 1,000 students in my physics class, or whatever. And they get bogged down in this idea of how do I get to know my, these people well enough for them to know me to write a letter. This isn't the case, obviously, at smaller institutions where you have a lot more touch with the faculty. But this comes up a lot. And what's your recommendation? Kristen, what do you say to students to get them to understand how they kind of get to the point of having that letter that's really going to be meaningful?
So I always recommend that students from the beginning of the semester approach a professor that they think they may want to ask to write a letter on their behalf, and just approach them and say, here's my situation. I'm planning to apply to medical school. As you may or may not know, a letter of recommendation is a requirement as, part of that application process. I would love to be able to get a letter of recommendation from you if you'd be willing to write one. And then ask them, what would you need from me this semester to feel comfortable writing an excellent letter on my behalf? And then obviously do those things. I also recommend that they utilize office hours. Every, you know, professor is going to have office hours, even if they have many large classes. So utilizing those times to make a connection, you know, pop in, ask questions about, you know, the topic of the week, or, you know, get clarification, or even if they feel like they have a good grasp on the material, just stopping in to kind of get their face seen, their name known, to really cultivate that relationship.
Yeah. And any further comments, Kristen, on sort of what makes a letter great? You know, in your mind, when you see a letter and you think, wow, this is a great letter, what does that mean?
So I feel like I can actually see the person, see that they know the person, and I get a feel for the applicant and who they are and how they operate. Maybe, like they said, in addition to what we see on the application, it is just seeing another side of them, and sometimes it's just backing up their claims, you know, showing that they are who they say they are. And those great letters I can feel it. I don't know how any other way to say it, but you can feel that you get, you know, an idea of who that person really is, because yeah, the letter writer is conveying that.
Yeah, that's good point. Layla, what are your thoughts on this relative to, you know, what makes this letter, you know, bam, this is so awesome?
You know, it's interesting because when we have those conversations exactly like the one that you shared, you know, there's 500 people in my class, how do I get the letter? You know, the question is, what part of application to medical school is easy? Right. So all parts of it require a lot of time and effort and work. Right. And so it is the student's responsibility to make themselves known to the faculty member. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's exactly what Kristen said, you know, spend time with the faculty member, show up to office hours. I think for those of us who have taught, we know office hours get really lonely, right? And that person that shows up who is eager to discuss and talk about what it is that they're learning in class, you know, sticks in our mind, and there's information that a student can share. And now that gap years have become more common, I mean, a frequent question is, well, I graduated last year and I can't get a faculty letter. Can I give you other letters? So I think what's important for students to understand is that the schools have the requirements. The requirements are what they are for a specific reason, right? So if you're applying to a school that has stipulations on the type of letter, then it's up to you to stay in touch with the faculty member. And I really appreciated what Kristen said. You know, in the beginning of the semester, if you see someone that you like them, then you begin to cultivate that relationship there. And so it's okay that you've graduated. I think faculty like to know where you are. And I don't even know if you have to approach them in the beginning to say that you're applying to medical school. It could be that you just have an interest, you know, in the class, but it's hard work, and we understand that. And I say this because the letters are so important, as you've heard from the three of us, right? It's a subjective reading on our part of the content of the letter. So the content of the letter in of itself is really important. And so it would be best for you not to get a perfunctory letter from a, you know, chemistry faculty member who's teaching a class of 270 people, and you're just one out of the three that got the A.
Yeah. Now, and so a good follow-up question to that, Layla, is this idea of, you know, I was in a class, it was a huge class, and I really got to know the grad student that was the TA for the class, or I really got to know the postdoc in the lab as opposed to the PI. Does that carry, is it different in terms of who this letter is coming from? Would it be better to have a really strong, well-written, intimate letter from the postdoc in the lab, rather than a sort of perfunctory, yeah, he worked in my lab, you know, blah, 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 whatever, coming from the PI? How do you weigh those two things relative to what they're saying about the student?
You know, Scott, that's a great question. And because I've worked at different med schools, the perspectives were different at the different locations, right? So we want an insightful letter. At my current location, if you provide a letter from the postdoc or the graduate student, that's really detailed and insightful, particularly since undergraduates are often, you know, the right-hand person for the fellows or the postdocs or the graduate students, it's fine for us. if the school to which you're applying, you know, requires that the letter be from the PI, it's always okay for you to ask the postdoc to ask the PI or the faculty member to endorse the letter. Mm-hmm. So we have many letters that have two signatures on them. Yeah. So the letter is written from the postdoc or fellow, and the faculty members or the PI's signature is on there as well. But what's important is that the letters are from individuals that know you well, who can write a good letter for you. You don't want to waste one of those spots of a letter that you have to submit. Don't think of this as just a box to check, right? There's a reason that we ask for the letters. It's more writing for us. More reading for us. So, right. So it's fine for our program.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Excellent. That's great. Any comments from Kristen, you or Joel relative to that? I mean, from your perspective, when you get a letter from a grad student, that was the lab instructor for chemistry or whatever, how does that impact your process as opposed to the professor of record for the course? Yeah, go ahead, Joel.
Oh, Kristen,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Joel.
Well, I was just reinforcing what Layla said. I think is really important is the content is what we're looking to evaluate. And I have seen composite letters where you have the faculty instructor's information at the top, their comments about the student, and then a much more detailed explanation of the activities the student was engaged in by the teaching assistant or the graduate student. But I think if you had to pick one or the other, for us, the one that gave us more light into who you are is more valuable to us, not the one with the credentials at the end of the name. And remember what you mentioned that some students complain about not having the access to faculty in large classes. And, you know, there are large prereq courses, but they're also, as you get into more rigorous and more specific subject matter, those classes become smaller. And so you should be able to make those connections. And also remember what the intent of the letter is. The letter is to give us some insight in your ability. And if you have had no contact at all with any faculty that can speak to that, other than you went to class every day, we wonder then what, you know, besides going to class, what else were you engaged in? And maybe it comes out through something else. So you need to be engaged in your academic arena more than just going to class and then going home. You have to go to the office hours, as I've said already. If you have if you stumble and don't do well, and you collaborate with your instructor to kind of find a way to get your pace back and to improve, even if you made a B in that class, their ability to talk about how you overcame an obstacle is really informative to us. Mm. So I would look for opportunities to get engaged in your learning other than just going to class and being passive in your learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Kristen, anything to add to that? Yeah.
I would echo what's been said and just kind of add to that. So we do require a letter from a science faculty member who is familiar with the applicant's work, but that person does not have to be that professor of record. It can be, someone else that's, you know, a TA in the classroom or a postdoc in the lab or, you know, whatever that might be. Or even a research supervisor or professor that maybe the student or the applicant didn't actually take a class from, but they might know them better because they've spent more time with them because they're so involved in the research. Mm-hmm. It does need to be a faculty member, so not a peer, obviously, but someone who knows the applicant best and can really speak to who they are and how they operate.
Yeah, good. So we've talked a little bit about great letters. I'm sort of interested in knowing how often do you receive really bad letters. I mean, I'm assuming that every now and then you get a letter that says, well, I'm not so sure about this student. Give us a little insight into that, you know, in particularly with regard to what you've all just kind of talked about, which is the students need to think carefully about who they're asking for letters from. And I've known in my own past as an admissions officer how that kind of works, and that at times we get letters where you think, wow, why did that student ask for this specific professor to write a letter for them? So I'm kind of interested, Kristen, have you seen any letters, or what do you do with a letter that just, or how often have you seen letters where they're just not really great letters?
So in my current role, because, we've been through this one cycle, I haven't seen a ton of really bad letters. But as an advisor, I saw not like bad letters in that they were recommending against the applicant, but more that they just clearly had nothing to say about them, I feel like is what came through more than anything in my experience. Mm-hmm. Is just that it was like a paragraph, and then it was clear that, they didn't know the applicant or didn't feel like they had a lot of great things to say about them. Of course, as an advisor, I couldn't let my students know that. And so that was tricky, but, but yeah, like I said, in this cycle, we haven't seen that with our applicants so far, but I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah, no doubt. Anybody seen really bad letters? Go ahead, Joel.
I was going to say, I think Kristen's point is really important. Oftentimes it's the absence of information that makes a poor letter. And so that's what you read as an evaluator. You're looking at what is said and what is not said. Sometimes we'll see two terrific letters and then one letter. This is very rare, but one letter that really has a negative comment in it. And sometimes we will follow up with that letter writer to get more information, to give us some insight. And then the committee will take that information in context with the other letters. But very rarely do you get a letter that says, oh, don't, I wouldn't recommend this student to care for my pets, much less my family. So right. In my house, actually, pets are first and then I'm second. So
I totally understand that. Layla, any comments about bad letters?
So I wanted to add to this a little bit. So I have seen some bad letters, but I agree with Joel and Kristen. We don't see too many of them, right? Generally, students are wise enough to request letters from faculty members and, individuals that they know will give them a letter of support. I think the piece of advice that I would have here if there's an individual where there was a fallout and the candidate feels that fallout was resolved, they really need to be certain that it was, right? So I have read letters where it was a two-sided recommendation, right? So the recommendation was, I have no doubt that this individual can handle the course, the load of medical school. I don't know how they will function in your environment, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, that's a bad letter because it speaks to all those, intangibles, right? It speaks to how they are as a peer, how they are as a team member, and all of those things. I mean, we can see that they can handle the coursework because of the grades and MCAT that they are providing to us. So I have seen letters, and those letters cause a lot of concern for the committee, particularly if it's an individual that, we're interested in. And I will share with you that the times that we have taken the risk and invited the individual to our campus, they have not done well in the environment. So so there's insight there. Now, what is the takeaway from this? Don't ask for a letter from a place where, you haven't functioned well in the context of a laboratory or something. I don't know what the takeaway is, but and again, it goes with that inherent subjectivity that's, in all of our programs, right? So we read the letter and we're waiting for the person to do something, maybe, and maybe something happens that would have been ignored or not seen if we didn't have that letter. But to answer the general question, have you seen bad letters? I have letters that'll say, admitting this person to your program is like allowing them to drive a bus off the side of a cliff, right? Why would you want that person in your medical school, even though they have a 4.0 and a 528 and, multiple publications at the undergraduate level? So we do see things like this. And so I feel that goes more to the letter writer, because they should not write a recommendation letter, right? This is a letter of recommendation. It's not a letter of reference. So I think there's a difference there. And so they should not have agreed to write the letter of recommendation, but they did. And now the medical school has that information. And so, you know, we will do with it what we can. But it has always borne out for us that the recommender's insight was accurate. And they took the time to do that, right? They didn't give us examples, but there was enough there for us to know that there was a concern.
Yeah. How often do you have to kind of read between the lines in a letter? You know, I mean, you know, this comes to the issue of nuances in terms of a letter. What, you know, are there times when you read a letter and you think, wow, they're not saying something, you know, outright, but I get the feeling from just the reading between the lines that there's something else going on here with this between this student and this letter writer. Do you see that, or do you try to reduce that sort of evaluation, or do you have to, you know, kind of pay attention to your gut when it comes to those types of things? Kristen, any thoughts about that?
I think that we probably see that quite a bit. We're just kind of, it's kind of the letters have kind of the message of like, they're fine, but they're not great. And seeing if they're not providing examples of kind of what they're saying, or their language is more neutral and not, they don't seem real excited about them. Then I feel like those are some lines that we try to read between and see like, okay, what's really going on here? And we're left to question, is there something more going on here, or do they just really not know the applicant and they're trying to do them a service? But, as was mentioned before, maybe that letter writer shouldn't be writing a letter on behalf of the applicant if they don't feel strongly in support of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Joel, do you have to read between the lines?
Well, we caution our committee for speculating. You know, you can't, if you don't have the evidence or the information, you really can't speculate that that's what it could be. The question is, does it support other past behavior in the application? And if the answer is no, the letter says they're fine, but there's nothing, like Chris said, any examples to support activity that they've been engaged in their application, then really the letter is, its impact is diminished because of the lack of information, not because we have speculated that there's something else going on. If there is any question that the committee has in which there's something that is, it's not between the lines, but it's unclear. It's been written, but it's unclear on what the meaning was. We will reach back to that letter writer and ask them to clarify. And then that is then presented to the committee again.
Do you find that letter writers, when you do have to reach out to them like that, do you find that they're willing to kind of be more sort of upfront with you in a phone call, for example?
Yes. I generally do ask them, though, to supply the information in writing so that we can present that to the committee.
Gotcha.
But it often starts with a conversation. And many times, it's the letter writer. I said, that was an omission. I should have mentioned that she was part of a lab that I collaborated with. She wasn't in my lab. And so we couldn't, for instance, we couldn't make that connection with what the letter writer was writing about. Or, no, that was not my intent. But occasionally, and this is pretty rare, it's, yes, there was an issue that occurred with the standards committee with this individual, and although they were not found to have violated standards, we were concerned by their behavior. Mm-hmm. So we would ask them to illuminate that a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. Layla, you were shaking your head when Joel was saying you kind of caution your committee not to read between the lines too much. You want to comment on that as well?
Yeah, I'll be happy to. You know, the times where we have, and I've done what Joel does, I've reached out to them. There really wasn't anything between the lines. It just was what they were sharing, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel that the individual letters rarely ask us to read between the lines, right? I feel that sometimes it's the committee letters that might have a little bit of read between the lines. And this might be getting too specific, but if there's a scoring mechanism, right, and then the like based on everything that you see, the person should get the highest ranking, but they don't, they get, you know, one lower or two lower, then there's something, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I've called, there wasn't anything that they wanted me to read between the lines, except to understand that, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're a fine applicant, but they are not as strong as the other students that they would have. So we caution our committee about reading between the lines as well. And probably Kristen and Joel have experienced this. I mean, you can get hung up on wordsmithing. And when I have gone back to faculty and asked them about this, they just laugh because it was not their intent for us to read anything other than what they had shared. So we try not to read between the lines and appreciate it when the language is, you know, just clear for us to be able to follow it.
Yeah, good. So you brought up committee letters, and that was the very convenient segue because I wanted to move on to that and talk a little bit about committee letters, because there are a lot of undergraduate institutions that have a committee process where they're asking students to do a variety of things, and then in the process of that, the pre-med committee does what they do and produces a letter of a summary letter, or sometimes it's just a composite of various comments from the. So I guess what my question relative to the committee process is, when you have a student coming from a school that you know has a committee process, and that student does not get the committee letter, they've got individual letters, there's no mention of the committee in their file, and does it make you wonder, why did this student not get a committee letter? Or do you just kind of take it on face value? Here's the letters we have. We'll look at them and evaluate the applicant based on that. What do you do with the either presence of a committee letter or the absence of a committee letter? So, Joel, why don't you address that? I know there's quite a few schools that you deal with on a real regular basis, particularly in Texas, that have committee process, and so I'm guessing that you guys deal with this kind of thing a lot.
Well, and as you know, a lot of the faculty at those institutions who are charged with producing all of the letters of recommendation for their campus, sometimes is an office of one or office of two. And so they have processes where the students have to go through certain steps in order to get access to that letter. And so sometimes you'll have a candidate who entered the stream a different way to the application process, met the prerequisites, followed the literature online and did what they needed to do, but they may not be able to get access to that committee letter. So we look at it on the face value of what they provide. And it is not, and some committee letters have actually kind of morphed into compilation letters, which is the equivalent of going out and getting three letters on your own. Now you're getting a compilation letter from the committee, and there isn't any additional scoring or recommendation with that packet. So everybody's got a little bit of a different flavor. I don't consider it a red flag if for some reason a student didn't go through the committee process. Maybe they're a non-traditional student. I think, again, there is so much content that we look at in its totality, that this is one piece of that interdigitates with all of it, and we look at it for its value, not its face value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Layla, any red flags when a student doesn't have a committee letter?
You know, I'm going to pull from my experience on this one, and originally it did. So when I was undergraduate pre-med advisor, I chaired our letter writing committee, and we did have cutoffs. And so there was a number of students who were not eligible to receive our letters, and those cutoffs were based on metrics at that point, you know, many, many years ago. And so, you know, in retrospect, that wasn't a good process for us to have in place because we did disadvantage some students. So I took that learning with me, and we have the perspective that Joel does. I mean, if a student has a committee letter and it's a well-written committee letter, it makes our job a lot easier, right? Because they have digested the information for us, they've analyzed it for us, and they've ranked the student in the context of all of the applicants that we get from, you know, this school, which is one of our top feeder schools. I know exactly what to expect from this individual coming in through the door on interview day as a student and as they leave my program, you know, as a trained physician. So it makes our job easier, but is it a red flag? It absolutely isn't, because there's, as Joel mentioned, there's so many different ways that students come to the medical school application process. And even if they are a traditional student, but a student who hasn't, you know, taken advantage of the advising office, and the requirement is that you must meet with us at least, you know, twice a semester to get a letter, then they're already at a disadvantage because they didn't have time to go to the office because they had a job or something. So it's not a red flag for us. Earlier on in my time as an admissions representative for a medical school, I would ask the question, if your school offers a committee letter, please describe why you do not have one if you don't have one. And it was tough, right? And it because speaking with our candidates at that point, that it made them feel bad about that, because automatically going in, they felt that there was a red flag on them for not having that thing that we were receiving from everyone else. So over time, I've realized too that it's not a good idea to look at that as a red flag if they don't have the committee letter.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's it sounds like an appropriate response to me. Kristen, what about you guys?
So we do require a letter from a pre-medical source, and that will accept an advisor letter, a composite evaluation, a committee letter, anything like that. And we don't consider it a red flag, as has been mentioned, if you don't have a committee letter and your school offers that, because there are a number of reasons why someone may not have that letter. And then also, if a pre-med source isn't available, then we will allow for a second faculty member or an employer letter. That might be more telling for non-traditional students to, you know, maybe have an employer letter if they've been out in the workforce, as opposed to going back and, you know, meeting with an advisor and trying to get a letter from someone that they really don't have a relationship with.
Don't know. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Kristen, while we're with you, I know that many osteopathic medical schools really want to see a letter from a DO, from a practicing osteopathic doctor. Does your school require a DO letter? And, you know, if a student comes into your process without a DO letter, what does that mean? How do you, you know, weigh that versus a student that has a DO letter? Talk a little bit about that.
So we do require a physician letter, and we will accept a letter from an MD or a DO physician. So we don't explicitly require a DO letter. Obviously, we would hope that they've had some exposure to osteopathic medicine and can speak to that. But they may have shadowed a DO, but didn't get to know that DO well enough to actually be able to get a letter of recommendation from them. But maybe they, you know, worked with an MD as an MA or something like that, and that physician could provide better insight into who they are as a person and how they might be as a physician or, you know, someone who cares for patients. So we don't explicitly require the DO letter. We would prefer it, but it's not an absolute requirement.
So. Yeah. Okay. I mean, Joel, what about Dale Medical School? You like to see letters from a physician? Does it matter? Tell us a little bit about on your end of things, how that might look.
It really doesn't matter. We don't have any kind of designation on the letter. I think, as the student said earlier, it needs to give us some insight into your experience and somebody else's experience with you, and they can speak to that. So if you have worked, for instance, in healthcare, and having somebody who could speak to your acumen for that profession, how you worked with the patients, how the patients felt comfortable with you as the physician's MA, and oftentimes you were able to make them feel more comfortable in the exam room, but you did the vitals. You know, that kind of observation is helpful, but that observation could come from a PI or it could come from an employer in a different environment as well. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have a checkbox of, you know, preference. Again, I think the preference is just something of substantive nature that can tell us more about who you are.
Right. Layla, any comments here?
No, I think I will just echo what you heard everyone else say. I mean, it's the letters need to be insightful, and they need to give us the additional information that we're looking for about the candidate. I think there's good guidelines on how to write letters, you know, from the AAMC. I encourage students to make that available to their letter writers and really get the letters from the individuals that know them best.
Yeah.
Not much to add here.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, that's good. Yeah. And it seems to me like that it's beneficial when you get the letter and to sort of encapsulate what all of you have said numerous times during this broadcast is that what you want to see is a letter from someone who knows the student well, who knows the student well enough to really address who they are and how strong of a candidate they are and or how well they think they're going to do within the environment, whether the letter is from a nurse that they've worked beside, whether it's from an EMT supervisor or a graduate student in the lab. The beneficial letter is the letter that says, I really know this person very well and can address in a strong way their capabilities, and those capabilities are X, Y, and Z. And I've witnessed this in a variety of different settings, or et cetera, et cetera. And that seems to me to be kind of what you're all saying, that students need to really find those individuals within the context of knowing that you really would like to see faculty members who can address those types of things. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about that already. But the strong letter is the letter that I know this person well. I'm going to tell you a little bit about them, and that this is going to give you insight that's going to help you in your decision-making process. Did I get that right, pretty much?
Joel, if I could add, I mean, it's really the person is putting their name behind the credibility of this individual as an applicant, you know, to the program and a member of our community, right? So when we get a letter from a nurse who has 37 years of experience and talks to us about the bedside manner, I'm not going to worry at all about how that candidate is going to fit into our community. So that's really what we're looking for, right? Helping us understand how they know them, and then why is it that this individual is a credible source to recommend someone for us to consider for a program, you know, above and beyond everything else that they've already submitted.
Yeah, yeah.
I would add one caveat, Scott, about the letter and having it written by somebody who really knows you well. Yes, with the exception of anybody who's a direct relation to you.
Right.
Or somebody who may be your next door neighbor who happens to be a physician and who will write, letter says, I've known Johnny since he was 6 years old, and I think he's an outstanding young man. You know, that has, by their inherent nature, letters should be biased. They have to be. That's why you've chosen people to write for you. But having that kind of nepotistic bias is problematic, and it lessens the effect of the letter. So really think about people you've gone out and sought to find out more about who you are and who can write about your experience.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah.
Can I just piggyback off of what Joel said? So the next door neighbor, we did have an amazing letter for a student who the next door neighbor did write the letter. He wasn't a physician, but this applicant had mowed their yard for free for the past like 17, 18 years. And that went a long way, right? Because it spoke about the individual's other-centeredness and all of that. So I agree with everything that Joel said, on top of, if there is that kind of relationship with a neighbor, that's okay too, because you're a good community member.
Yeah.
And that's what we want, right? We want someone who's going to make our community better. And so if you were giving another centered where you lived, we hope that you will bring that to our community as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So note to all the students that are listening, go mow the lawn of your neighbor today. Go start that process. No, I'm kidding.
Scott, can I give you my address just so
yeah,
in the area?
Right, exactly. Kristen, any final thoughts that, you know, we've got basically 152 students and that are listening and watching live, probably more than that. We have a lot of students that will be listening to this later on our YouTube TV channel and potentially podcast listeners as well. So we want to give them, you know, any morsels of wisdom that you have as we close this off that you would think would be helpful for these students to hear from you.
Ooh, no pressure with a
build right. up like
morsels. So I would say, just kind of putting on my old advisor hat, start looking at the schools that you think that you want to apply to and get familiar with their letters of recommendation requirements and start thinking about who you might be able to get to fill those requirements and build those relationships now and, you know, start to build them, but continue to cultivate and nurture those relationships. And I think that's my morsel.
Yeah, there you go. I guess, Joel, you know, you alluded to an analogy of a gemstone earlier. Any other gemstone you have for us today?
I think that who you pick as your letter writer gives us some insight into who you are, but also some of your own self-awareness. And that's part of how you made your decision who you wanted to write about you. So if you think about your accomplishments, what you want to highlight, as I said earlier, and then you go out and find those individuals who can speak to that, that really helps pull together your application. It's not just one piece of information. It's really the tapestry of your whole application that we're looking at and how all that's interwoven. When threads don't really connect is when it's more difficult to really kind of draw that conclusion.
Yeah.
So think about what you want to highlight in your application and think about the individuals who can speak to those experiences and speak to them well based on your working relationship with them.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And Layla, any last words of wisdom from you today?
So I will like to have some comments about the mechanical parts of this process. So we've talked about all the substantive parts, right? So see what the requirements are for the letters. I mean, if it needs to be on letterhead, if it needs to have a signature, make sure that you have those so the letters are not denied by the school. If the school has a platform where you can see what's missing, check that out. If not, you know, email the school to see what the requirements are. If you've waived your ability to see the letter, then you really won't know. So you don't want your application to be held back because of those things, right? And request your letters early enough so that they get there at the time that you're submitting your supplemental so that your application can be completed. So it's some of these mechanical things that sometimes hold the applications back. I mean, we had to deny lots of students this year because of those things. And then please know, if we require a signature but your person can't sign because they don't have a scanner at home, it's okay for you to let us know that, right? We want to work with you. We're excited about every application that we receive. So outside of all of the substantive morsels that Kristen right. and Joel provided, I'll just give this mechanical one.
Yeah, there you go. No, that's awesome. Well, I want to, again, thank all of you for being here today. This has been super informative. I think the students will find that the things that you've said are very helpful in terms of understanding both how the process works, but also things that they can do on their end of things to really make it advantage them and to be a good candidate. They desperately want to be good candidates for your schools, and we're excited to help them here at MAP to in order to do that. And that's one of the reasons we do this particular broadcast, is to just give students as much information. And I appreciate your transparency and your willingness to kind of give us this window into your processes. And so thank you very much, Layla, Kristen, and Joel. Thank you for spending some time with us today, and have a great rest of your day. And we'll probably tap you again sometime soon for another one of these, if that would be okay. But we really appreciate you being here. And thank you to all the students that have watched and listened, and we will check back with you in about a month from now We'll give you the dates and stuff later and the topic. Every month we have a Inside Med Admissions broadcast, and we have a new topic. And I think we've pretty much decided that the next topic we're going to tackle in the month of May is going to be secondary applications. Secondary applications, what are they all about? How do you use them? Various questions with regard to this whole process that we ask students to do beyond that of the primary application. So again, thank you to our guest, and have a great rest of your day, everyone. And we'll catch you later.
All right, so there you have it. Again, that was Inside Med Admissions, hosted by Dr. Scott Wright. This is a monthly series that my MAPT team puts on, and you can show up live. Again, it's typically the last Wednesday of every month at 1 p.m. Eastern, but as always, replays are available on our YouTube channel at mapt.tv. That's mapd.tv. Have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.